On November 20th, 2006, 19-year-old Jesse Warren Ross called his mother and told her about the incredible time he was having in Chicago at the Model UN conference. He and several classmates from the University of Missouri, Kansas City had made the trip just days earlier, but Jesse would never make it home. At around 2 a.m. on November 21st, a select group of students, including Jesse, attended a late-night crisis simulation at the Sheraton on East North Water Street, where the conference was being held. The simulation was expected to last for hours, but around 30 minutes in, Jesse stood up, said he needed a break, and walked out of the conference room. It has now been more than 18 years since Jesse disappeared, leaving his friends and family still searching and still wondering what happened to Jesse Ross that night. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube, listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. And you may have noticed if you're watching on YouTube, we're right around 100,000 subscribers. I think we're maybe 2,000 or 3,000 away. So if you haven't already, I would really appreciate it if you just take a second right now, hit that subscribe button and make sure that your notifications are turned on. I see a lot of people in the comments saying, hey, I'm subscribed, but I'm not getting notifications about your videos. Just make sure that bell's on and you should be all set. So we cover a lot of cases here. We almost cover one every single week. And in many instances, it's clear that foul play is involved. It's a whodunit, right? Who's involved? How did it happen? We're trying to put that puzzle together. This case, it's more of a spectrum. There's a real possibility that foul play is involved. But on the other end, it's also very possible that this is just a tragic accident. There's a lot of variables at play here. And whenever you have a person just vanish without a trace, you're going to have a lot of people asking questions, especially when it's a young student who's only visiting for a short period of time. And it appears, at least on the surface, that they're inside a hotel, which has a lot of people and a lot of cameras. And yet here we are 18 plus years later, and we don't know where Jesse is. So yes, it's going to raise some eyebrows. There's going to be a lot of people who want answers. And this is something that came on my desk, not through a recommendation, but through our researchers. And also there's a great YouTube video, documentary, I would even call it, online about this case. I had the opportunity to watch it. It was fascinating. So I'm looking forward to diving into it, giving you all the facts of the investigation, giving you my perspective on where we stand today, and then break down where we can go from here. So without wasting any more time, let's dive into this week's case. Jesse Warren Ross was born on February 18, 1987 to parents Donald and Donna. He was always active growing up in the Kansas City, Missouri area. He ran track, played soccer, and was involved in both the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts. He was a loving son who also had a pretty cool tradition of watching the Charlie Brown holiday movies with his mom. And I throw that in there not because it's going to contribute to the investigation, but I think it's important to remember that just like you and I, he had a great life and also a really awesome future ahead of him. And yet here we are discussing some not so great circumstances. So I think it's always great to throw those little things in there so we can relate to these people on a personal level and not just as a victim in a case. Now, during high school, Jesse and his older brother, Andy, worked together at a local movie theater in Lee's Summit. And according to his family, the two made lifelong friends there. One particular friend was a member of the band and Jesse was inspired by that. So he made his senior project a battle of the bands, raising money for charities in the process. So again, I bring this up to show you that Jesse was a great kid. He had his head screwed on right, and he was on the right path. After high school, Jesse attended the University of Missouri, Kansas City on an academic scholarship, majoring in communications and minoring in political science. As part of his minor, he participated in the Model UN And for his communications major, he landed an internship at the radio station 95.7 The Vibe, and he quickly became an integral part of the station and was even given an on-air personality, Opie Cunningham. His father, Donald, told Missing Illinois that his name was a reference to fellow redhead Ron Howard's two most famous roles, Opie on The Andy Griffith Show and Richie Cunningham on Happy Days. And Jesse was so well-loved at the station, he was offered a paid position, which was set to start in January of 2007. But before this could happen, Jesse needed to attend the Model UN Conference in Chicago, held in November of 2006, with more than 1,000 participants from across the country in attendance. It was the second year he was attending, and he was excited for the opportunity. On the morning of Saturday, November 18th, Jesse's dad dropped him off with the rest of the UMKC group, which included their faculty sponsor, Derek Moorhead, and 12 other students. The group piled into rented vans and made the 8-hour drive to Chicago, and after arriving, Moorhead and the students checked into their hotel, the Four Points Sheraton, which was located roughly a mile from the main conference hub at the Sheraton on 301 East North Water Street in the Loop. Jesse roomed with an old high school friend, Ralph Parker, and according to the Medium, the two spent most of the weekend together as part of the Model UN Security Council. When they weren't in the meetings, they explored the city side by side. And that's exactly what they planned to do before their final session on the 20th. Now, to start that day, Jesse called his mom and told her how much fun he was having. Later, he and Ralph visited the Harley-Davidson store and then grabbed food at the Hard Rock Cafe before heading back to the conference for a 6 p.m. meeting. The session was expected to last until around 9:30 p.m., followed by a dance for all attendees. But when the meeting ended, most of the students told faculty sponsor Derek Moorhead that they weren't interested in going to the dance. Instead, Jesse and 11 other students returned to their hotel around 10 p.m., and Moorhead and one of his graduate students decided to go out for food instead of heading back with the group. Now, once back at the hotel, Jesse and his friends broke one of the conference rules: no alcohol. They spent the next few hours drinking before deciding to actually check out the dance at the conference hotel. So at 12:43 a.m., surveillance footage captured Jesse leaving the hotel alone, carrying a plastic bottle as he walked toward the Sheraton where the conference was being held. 26 minutes later, at 1:09 a.m., security cameras at the Sheraton captured him entering the building, and according to Medium, once inside, he smiled for photos at the dance while carrying a Powerade bottle filled with a cocktail that included vodka, and there are numerous photos of him walking around with that Powerade bottle. After briefly attending the dance, Jesse headed to the 8th floor for a hotel room party, where he stayed until it was time for the late-night crisis simulation for the Model UN Security Council members. Then at around 2 a.m., he made his way to the designated meeting area in the conference room. Some of the students at the session, including Jesse's roommate Ralph, later told the filmmakers of When I Last Saw Jesse that Jesse was visibly intoxicated. While some recalled that he needed help walking, Ralph insisted he was still coherent, and I think the two can be true. If you watch the documentary, it's on YouTube. I'll have some more information at the end. There were multiple people that said he could barely walk, that he needed assistance walking through the conference room. So I think you can be coherent and still communicative, but also not have your balance. So I think they're both right here. I definitely think, based on the accounts of what happened that night and from what I was watching, it's clear that he was drunk. It's as simple as that. I'm not trying to make him look bad. I'm not trying to demean him or minimize what happened here, but it's important for the story. As I said at the top of this episode, there's a spectrum here. This is foul play or it's a tragic accident. And when we think about a tragic accident, we have to ask ourselves, how could it have happened? And when we start getting into the geography of the area where Jesse was last seen and the bodies of water that are there, you start to ask the question of how he could have ended up in that water. And I think it is reasonable to assume, if he's intoxicated and he's having trouble walking, is it possible that he accidentally fell into the water? Of course it is. So I bring this up not for any other reason than it's an important component of the story, especially as we're considering different scenarios. So they're in this meeting in the conference room, and then at around 2:30 a.m., Jesse said something to Ralph, but Ralph didn't catch it. And as he started to ask Jesse to repeat himself, Jesse just stood up and left the room. Now, another member of the Security Council ran into Jesse as he was exiting, and he was concerned based on Jesse's demeanor, so the student asked him if he was okay, and Jesse assured him that he was and he would be right back. And I do want to stop for a second and point out that I'm going with 2:30 a.m. as the time when this occurred, because that's what I'm seeing in most reports. But I do want to note that in the documentary, I think it was Ralph that was giving the interview at this point, and he said that they were in there for around 20 to 30 minutes, and it was around 2:50 a.m. when Jesse left the building. And he could have been wrong. I'm just pointing it out because Ralph was there and I wasn't, and I don't want to leave anything out of this. So if you go back and watch the documentary and you hear Ralph say, oh, it was around 2:50 a.m., just know that I caught that. But based on other accounts, based on investigative reports, I'm going with 2:30, but it could be anywhere in that window. So Jesse did leave that room, but he never returned, and Ralph assumed that Jesse had just gone back to their hotel. So after the crisis simulation ended, Ralph made his way back to their room as well, arriving before 6 a.m. When he walked in, he saw a shape on Jesse's bed, and because of the dim lighting, he thought it was Jesse sleeping, so he went to bed without a second thought. But when he woke up at around 10 a.m., he realized that it wasn't Jesse, it was just a pile of clothes. And that's where this story starts to pick up, and we're going to get right into that after this break. All right, we're back. And before the break, I had mentioned that Ralph went to sleep with this like figure on Jesse's bed, thinking it was him. It wasn't. He wakes up in the morning, realizes it wasn't. And at first, Ralph wasn't completely alarmed. But as checkout time came and went with no sign of Jesse, that's when concern set in. Ralphie called Jesse's cell phone multiple times, but every call went straight to voicemail. So he decided to walk back to the conference hotel to see if Jesse was there, but there was no sign of him anywhere. And that's when he finally decided to tell faculty sponsor Moorhead. And Derek Moorhead immediately took action. He questioned every student in their group, but none of them had seen Jesse since around 2:30 a.m. One by one, they all tried calling Jesse's phone, but every call went straight to voicemail. So then they started knocking on all the doors of other attendees, asking if anyone had seen him, but no one had. At around 1:30 p.m., Moorhead reported Jesse missing to hotel security, so security staff along with Jesse's classmates searched for a little while longer, but again, he was nowhere to be found. Now, according to the documentary, when I last saw Jesse, Moorhead eventually went to the Chicago Police Department to file a missing persons report. He later recalled the moment where he called Jesse's father, Donald Ross. After identifying himself, he said, quote, "I'm here in Chicago. I can't find Jesse." It was the kind of phone call every parent dreads. I can tell you, this is why people think I'm crazy. I just got back from a cruise, and my older daughter, Tenley, she's 12. I was there with some of my aunts and cousins, and you know, Tenley wanted to go to the bathroom, which was outside the windjammer. If you've been on a cruise before with Royal Caribbean, you know what that is. It's kind of like a cafeteria. And she's like, "I'm just going to run to the bathroom real quick, Dad." And I'm like, "Yeah, no, I'm going with you." Or Grandma's going with you, or Auntie Megan's going with you, because you're not going out there. And I had a couple of my cousins make fun of me, like, you really are like you're a helicopter parent. Like, you don't leave them alone. And I said to them, well, it's a really simple explanation. I've covered a lot of these cases and I've heard from a lot of parents. And there's one thing that I've taken from all these years of doing these investigations. I'd rather get up for a minute or two and inconvenience myself by going to the bathroom with her than getting that dreadful call or notice that your daughter can't be found. We've looked all over. We don't know where she is. All for me not wanting to get up and put my eggs down for 10 seconds to walk her to the bathroom. So risk worth reward. I'm going to go do that because I don't ever want to be in Donald Ross's position. Now, in this particular case, there's nothing Donald could have done. At some point, I know that Tenley and Peyton are going to go out there and they're going to explore the world. But I can tell you right now, I don't care how many times it happens, I will always have that feeling in the pit of my stomach where when they're gone and I'm not with them and I can't be that helicopter parent, I will be nervous every time I pick up the phone. And this case and many others like it is the exact reason I feel that way. It's one of the burdens to working in investigations and covering true crime. Now, back in Kansas City, a blizzard prevented the Ross family from heading to Chicago right away, but they knew something was wrong. Jesse wasn't the type to just disappear. He was a pretty responsible kid, and he wasn't suicidal. He had a very bright future ahead of him. Now, after making that call, Derek Moorhead was unsure of what else he could do, so he sent the other students home while he stayed behind. So Ralph drove one of the vans while another student drove the other van. And with the rest of the students home safe, Moorhead remained in Chicago, determined to find Jesse. He retraced every possible route between the two hotels, searching dumpsters, alleyways, even a construction site along the way. But despite his efforts, he didn't locate any sign of Jesse. The next morning, detectives arrived at the hotel with a dive team to search the Chicago River, which was just 25 feet away from the hotel, but during their entire search, the team found nothing. The investigation continued as detectives attempted to contact every student who attended the conference, which, as I said earlier, was more than 1,000 people. But the majority didn't respond or outright refused to make any statements. Now, why that is, I truly don't know. I'm sure there's part of it where you don't want to say something that could potentially jeopardize you by saying something wrong, even though you had nothing to do with Jesse's disappearance. Another part of it is, as I mentioned earlier, there were some students that were participating in some things that were against conference rules, and maybe they didn't want to incriminate themselves. Without actually being there and having the opportunity to review the reports or be on those phone calls when they were made, I don't want to speculate too much, but I did think it was important to include this because, again, spectrum. On one end, it's a tragic accident. At the other end, it's foul play. And we're going to talk about the different scenarios involving foul play, and we're going to get into it more later, but a little bit of a spoiler alert here. One of those scenarios that we're going to explore is the possibility that whatever happened to Jesse happened inside the hotel, which would mean that the offenders were either hotel staff, someone else staying at the hotel, or one of the conference attendees. So I bring all this up to make that point where there is a possibility that some people are not being cooperative because they know more than they're willing to say. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just putting it out there. So with little cooperation and even less information, investigators struggled to determine whether anyone had played a role or witnessed anything important in Jesse's disappearance. And that's always going to be a struggle. Cases are hard to solve even when you have all the information. But when you have this big hotel and you have people that were present at that hotel not willing to speak with you, it's going to make your job more difficult. That's just the reality of the situation. But regardless of how difficult it was going to be, investigators continued their work. They pulled cell phone records and reviewed surveillance footage from both hotels Jesse had been at before his disappearance. Now, just a reminder, that's the Four Points Sheraton, where Jesse had been staying, and then also the Sheraton on East North Water, which is where the conference was being held. In the end, investigators determined that Jesse was last seen on surveillance footage at 2:30 a.m., walking out of the conference hotel and then back inside. He was never captured on camera again, and according to the documentary, When I Last Saw Jesse, his cell phone had a signal for up to an hour afterward around 3:30 a.m., but after that, there was nothing. Investigators then reviewed every security and surveillance camera along the 15-minute walk back to Jesse's hotel on North Rush Street. Now, this path was well lit and well covered by cameras, but at no point was Jesse ever seen walking back. And that just didn't make sense. However, Jesse's friend, Ralph Parker, later offered a possible explanation as to why that may be the case. He explained that Jesse, like many of the other students, often used a shortcut to exit the conference rooms. Now, the shortcut door in the Security Council meeting room led to multiple exits. One led to the escalators, which was well covered by cameras, but another led to a stairwell that opened into the valet parking area, which had a dark spot with no surveillance coverage. And this is something that you can see in the documentary as well. But essentially, and I'm going to try to describe it as best as I can, when you're in the conference room, you have a couple different ways you can go if you go out the shortcut. The first one would be down this long corridor that leads to the escalators. And these escalators, which we're going to talk about a little bit more, they have a camera right on them. Now, if he had taken these escalators, there are glass doors that are right there. And outside these glass doors is the Chicago River. So if he had taken that route, let's say he was in the conference room, he got sick and he goes down that way. He goes down the escalators, goes out the glass doors to throw up or whatever. He could have fallen in the river. But as I just mentioned, there's cameras on that escalator and he never passed through them. So it's reasonable to assume that he went out the other way, which is up these stairs, which takes you right out to this, back out to the entrance. And this is the same entrance that he was seen on camera at around 2:30. But here's the thing, and I'm trying to describe it as best as I can. Maybe Shannon can throw up some visuals here. But the way the camera is, the entrance where he was walking in, right? It's very well lit. You could see him, no problem. But the area where he would have exited is much further away from the camera. And on the video footage, you can see it's completely dark. You can't see anybody entering or exiting. So it's very possible that he exited through that way, the valet parking way. And because the camera is so far away and because it was at night, he exited. And even though we have the footage, we just can't see him. So I hope I described that correctly. But again, same surveillance camera that picked him up earlier. But if he went out that way, he went out a different exit, which was much, much further away, and you wouldn't be able to tell. So I watched the surveillance footage. It's grainy. You can kind of see it in the documentary. There's no way you would pick up anybody leaving. But if we're to assume he left the building, that's the only way he could have left without being caught. So obviously, Ralph suggested that this shortcut was the only way Jesse could have left the hotel without being captured on camera, and I do agree with him. And faculty advisors also confirmed that the conference attendees often use this shortcut to save time for their walk. So it all lines up. If Jesse's trying to get out of the building fast, for whatever reason, and we'll talk about that as well, this would be the potential way he would have went, and it would have been the shorter route as well. So that could potentially explain why Jesse wasn't caught on surveillance footage after leaving the conference room, but it doesn't answer the question where he went after that. As I just mentioned, there's cameras along that route back to Jesse's hotel. He wasn't seen anywhere. So with no sign of Jesse, fears grew that he may have been a victim of a robbery gone wrong, or he just trusted the wrong person, leading to his demise. And these weren't just random theories. Just 1 year earlier, Jesse had attended the Model UN in Chicago as a freshman, and he wanted to document the experience, so he borrowed his father's video camera for the trip. But when he returned home, the camera was gone. According to Medium, Jesse told his father that one night around 1 a.m., he had gone out to take photos of the city. And while he was wandering around, a man approached him with a knife and mugged him, stealing the camera. No police report was ever filed, but as you can imagine, the incident left his parents shaken. So before he left for the 2006 conference, they reminded him to be careful. And Jesse agreed to do so, and this time he didn't bring a camera, but he did bring some burned CDs. Now, he had recently told friends that he wanted to get into the rave scene as a DJ and that the CDs were his samples. He even mentioned them to a faculty advisor, saying he hoped to make connections while he was in Chicago. His loved ones later wondered if he had met someone he thought could help him with his aspirations of becoming a DJ, and maybe that meeting led to something terrible. But the CDs weren't the only thing that Jesse had with him. Witnesses said that he was also carrying around $400 in $20 bills. And when investigators searched his belongings left at the hotel room, they realized that aside from his phone, wallet, and the clothes he had been wearing, only two other things were missing. Those CDs I just mentioned, and the $400 in cash. And obviously, when we think about potential scenarios involving foul play, I just mentioned that something could have happened inside the hotel. Well, what if he did leave? What if he went through that exit that was dark, and on his walk, he encountered someone just like he did the year before, but this time things took an even worse turn. And having those CDs and that money on him could have been a reason it went that way. We're going to continue on. We're going to take our last break. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. And with no clear evidence of what happened to Jesse, police eventually stopped their physical search. They told his family that his body had most likely washed out to sea and that they would never get their son back. As expected, this was devastating for Jesse's parents. They needed to know what happened to their son, and they weren't going to stop. And they didn't stop, but as years passed without answers, they decided to take a different approach. In 2011, Jesse's father, Donald, published Where's Opie? Vanished in Chicago, a book about the five long years without Jesse. He described it as, quote, part journal, reflecting both the family's longing for resolution and his own frustration with the case. He made it clear that he didn't accept what the police had told him. He wasn't willing to believe Jesse was simply gone without proof. But there was also a softer side to the book, where Donald wrote about the need to share Opie's story with as many people as possible. He hoped it would offer insight to other families facing the same unimaginable reality, a missing child. Unfortunately, since that book's release, there have been no major updates in the case. Over the years, a few age-progressed photos have been released, with the most recent in 2017, showing what Jesse might look like at 30 years old. There has been no activity on his cell phone and no movement on his financial records, so no indication that he ran off to start some new life. Absolutely no trace of him has been seen since his phone lost signal up to an hour after he left the hotel. For the Ross family and Jesse's friends, it has now been 18 long years, and they remain desperate for answers. All right, let's dive into this perspective, and I may jump around a little bit, but I'm going to try to keep an outline of three potential scenarios that I think are at play here. Obviously, there's more, but I want to cover the three that stand out to me the most. The first one being that something happened to Jesse inside the hotel. I'd kind of alluded to this earlier where it could explain why some people are not cooperative. You could have a scenario where something happens at the party upstairs. Maybe they're doing more than alcohol. Maybe there's a confrontation that we're unaware of. But after Jesse leaves that hotel party upstairs with those other students and comes downstairs, there's an arrangement to go back up there with multiple students. Could Jesse have gone upstairs with some other characters? Something goes wrong. Something happens to Jesse. And when I say something went wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was intentional. It also could have been an accident. As I mentioned earlier, Jesse was stumbling a little bit, having trouble keeping his balance. He could have fallen and hurt his head, maybe injured himself severely. He also could have taken something that he didn't know he was taking or took too much of something. And at that point, maybe these other students who also have big futures ahead of them decide, we can't report this because we're going to be held responsible. So they decide to do something else. What that is, I'm not even going to sit here to speculate. It would be very difficult to do because of the cameras inside that hotel. But if they were able to get outside with Jesse, they could have taken him and thrown him into the river. Or, and this is a little bit even more demonic, but we've seen it before in other cases, where if Jesse was rendered unconscious or dead, they could have placed him into some luggage or suitcase and got him out that way, where you see him exiting the building, but unfortunately we're unable to tell that it's him because he's inside a suitcase. Now, I say all this to say, I really don't think that's the scenario. I really don't, for a variety of reasons. The biggest one being, and I've said it before, when more than one person knows about something, it's no longer a secret. So if there's multiple students that were involved in this quote-unquote cover-up, there's some level of culpability for each person, and it's going to be less for some than others. And so with those people, they're more likely to come forward or at least tell someone, which would eventually get back to Jesse's family or law enforcement. That has never happened. The same holds true if somehow the hotel is involved with Jesse's disappearance. I've seen some reports of that on different platforms where people believe if Jesse was hurt inside the hotel, hotel staff could have done something to cover this up to avoid any type of legal ramifications. Obviously, that's possible. But again, you have the cameras everywhere. It doesn't appear that anything's missing. And if the hotel staff is involved with this, we got to be realistic here. The people working at that hotel, they're not all owners in the company. They don't necessarily care if the hotel gets sued for something because it's not going to come back on them. You're talking about valet drivers. You're talking about attendants. You're talking about house cleaning. Are they going to cover up a murder or an accidental death for a hotel that's paying them a little bit above minimum wage? I don't see it. At minimum, they would have told someone, and again, it would have gotten back to the people who could do something about it. So the fact that after all these years, we've never heard anything about these scenarios that have any validity to them, any actual credibility where we could explore it. I mean, to me, it's very unlikely that this is the scenario where Jesse was inside the hotel, was accidentally killed or had a serious injury or was hurt by another person, and a group of people were able to cover this all up without any trace of evidence suggesting an accident or foul play. Which brings us to the second theory, which is that this was a tragic accident and Jesse fell into the Chicago River. As we talked about, he was intoxicated, having trouble walking. Was he sitting in the conference room during this meeting and he fell ill and decided to get up and walk out? Possible. It's also possible that he was in there and he was bored and he wanted to go do something else, maybe go explore a rave party or, you know, pass out his CDs. So again, he decides to leave. Once leaving, he may have gone through that exit door, which wasn't caught on camera, and he could have made his way back to the river. Now, why would he go back towards the river? The only thing that I can think of, and weigh in down in the comments below if you have some other scenarios, would be that if he wasn't feeling well. If he was feeling sick and he didn't want to throw up on the sidewalk, maybe he would go over to the Chicago River in order to throw up there. Seems like a lot to do. I unfortunately have been there before where when you got to throw up, you got to throw up. And the last thing you care about is making sure it's clean. You'll find a bush, a sidewalk, or a dark alley, anywhere you can go just to, you know, take care of your business and get rid of what you want to get rid of. I'm trying to be as respectful as I can here. But another scenario could be that he was going outside to get some fresh air and he wanted to just go look at the Chicago River. And upon going over there, he stumbles and accidentally falls in either while throwing up or while just looking out at the water. And this is a very plausible scenario. I've had this in other cases that I've covered. I covered a case in Minnesota, which it was similar to this, where if Jesse entered the water, there's a couple things I want to point out. On that particular night, the high was 46 degrees. The low was 32 degrees. And the Chicago River was explored, but with that temperature, it's possible that he sunk to the bottom and then he could have floated downriver. And you're talking about a needle in a haystack for the dive team. It's very possible that they missed him. And another thing that was pointed out by investigators during that documentary was that at approximately 7:30 a.m., there's these locks at the Chicago River that would lead out to Lake Michigan. And they were open around 7:30 a.m. So if Jesse was in the river and had floated downriver, there would have been a potential that he could have gone through those locks and then out into Lake Michigan. And once that happens, a needle in a haystack doesn't even accurately describe how hard it would be to find him. So although it would take a few different things for this to happen, it is very possible. And I do think that when we step back and we think about what happened, it is a very likely scenario. Somehow or another, he ended up in the Chicago River. Now, I will say this. The first theory that I laid out, where foul play or an accident inside the hotel happened, is also still at play here, because when we're talking about the disposal of Jesse, it is also possible that whoever was involved decided to throw him in the river as well to make it look like an accident. Now, they may have gotten lucky and his body was never found, but it's still possible that he ended up in the water through those locks and out into Lake Michigan. And I do want to point out, just for the sake of transparency, when it comes to the scenario involving the Chicago River, there are some reports that detectives told Jesse's father, Donald, that they believed he walked out of the conference doors and then right in front of him would have been the glass doors leading to the Chicago River. Donald pushed back on that and said, that's not true. That's not the layout. They're wrong. And this could have just been something that's lost in the media, but based on the maps that I've seen, you come out of the conference room, you have to walk down a long hallway, then you have to take escalators, which lead to the glass doors. And as I've said multiple times in this episode, if he had taken those escalators, we would have him on security camera, and we don't. So I'm with Donald on this part where we say there's no way Jesse could have gotten to those glass doors without being captured on camera. That's the truth. It doesn't mean he didn't take an alternate route outside the building to get down to the river, but as far as those glass doors being the point of egress, I don't think it's possible. I disagree with investigators if that's the conclusion they came to, unless there's another blind spot or another angle that I'm unaware of. Now, the final theory that I want to discuss is, in my opinion, the most likely. We're looking at a situation where you have an intoxicated young adult who is bored at this conference. It's late at night and he doesn't want to be there anymore. If he were ill, I don't know if he would have said anything to Ralph on his way out the door, and I don't think he would have reassured the other student that he was okay. I think he would have just ran out to throw up. So more than likely, he was leaving intentionally because he wanted to go somewhere else. And I do believe that Ralph is probably right. He went out the exit that would lead to the stairs, that would lead up to the valet area, which is on camera, but as I mentioned, so far in the distance and so late at night that even if he went out that exit, you would not see him. I do believe that's what happened. And then what potentially went down after that is a question, but one likely scenario would be you have this young adult walking alone that's clearly intoxicated and would be an easy victim of opportunity for anybody who's in the area looking to commit a crime. This person approaches Jesse. He's got money on him. He's got CDs on him. And at that point, something goes down and it leads to an outcome that none of us want. And I do think it's still possible that if this happens near the Chicago River, that's how his body ends up there. That's why we don't have any evidence of him after all these years, is that something went down as soon as he left and there is another person involved, but that person disposed of his body by throwing him into the Chicago River. And if you only have one or two people involved, that would make sense as to why all these years later, no one has come forward. There's been no evidence of what occurred and no one inside the hotel has any information to provide that could help solve this case. But I do think that his cell phone being on till 3:30 a.m. is indicative of something happening much later after leaving the hotel. He could have been walking or he could have went to a location where he met up with some people. And what happened after that? There's a million different scenarios. I can think of a potential overdose. I can think of him accidentally falling. I could think of him getting in a fight. Or, as I said earlier, a robbery gone wrong. There's a million different ways that something could have happened to Jesse where the people involved decided, instead of reporting it to the police, they were going to handle it themselves. How that occurred, we may never know. The phone going off could be a variety of things. It could be intentionally turned off, or it could have been thrown in the river, or it could have went in the river with Jesse. There is really just so many questions to hone in on one specific theory, but my personal and professional takeaway is that Jesse did leave that hotel. I do believe he left alone, and something happened to him shortly after. I do not believe the answers to what occurred to Jesse are inside that hotel, although I will say there may be people who spoke with Jesse and had an idea of what he might be doing later who could help solve this case. And that's where you guys come in. So to give a quick recap, 19-year-old Jesse Warren Ross was attending a Model UN conference in November 2006 in Chicago. On the night of the 20th, he returned to his hotel, the Four Point Sheraton on North Rush Street, with his classmates. After drinking for a few hours, they decided to attend the conference dance at the Sheraton on East North Water Street. Surveillance footage captured Jesse walking from his hotel to the conference hotel at around 12:45 a.m. on what was now November 21st. He was wearing a white t-shirt, a green hoodie, blue jeans, and black sneakers. The last confirmed sighting of him was at 2:30 a.m. when cameras recorded him leaving the conference hotel and then walking back in. He has not been seen since. At the time of his disappearance, Jesse was 5'10 and weighed approximately 140 pounds. He had short red hair, blue eyes, and freckles, and often went by the nickname Opie. He also wore glasses. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Chicago Police Department at 312-745-5206 or the Missouri State Highway Patrol Missing Persons Unit at 1-800-877-3452. And if you want to know more about this case, I referenced the documentary on YouTube multiple times. It's called When I Last Saw Jesse, and it's under the YouTube account Brian Robert Rose. It's extremely well done. It's about an hour and a half long. I strongly recommend you go check it out. And as always, I'll end with some parting words for Jesse's friends and family. I do want to point out that Derek Moorhead, he's no longer with us. He's passed away. And also, tragically, Ralph Parker died in a motor vehicle accident at the age of 25. It's actually in the documentary. There's some footage of it. Horrific. Seemed like he really had his life together. Good person. And he would be critical to this case moving forward if we could go back and interview him. But to bring this back to the family for a moment, specifically Donna and Donald, I know it's been a horrific 18 years for you guys, and you're not going to stop fighting and looking for your son. And now we're here with you for as long as it takes. I know it's an uphill battle, but I'm hoping with the exposure from people like myself and others that someone does eventually come forward and give you the resolution that you deserve. I'm hoping that day comes sooner than later, and if it does, I will be right here sharing it with all of you. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.